I'm Carlos Virgen, and this is The Storyline, produced by The Day in New London, Connecticut. We continue with our series of conversations with local artists of color on how the recent events leading to the widespread anti-police brutality protests have influenced their creative lives. On this episode, Rick Koster talks to Michael Bradford, head of the Dramatic Arts Department at UConn and artistic director of the Connecticut Repertory Theater, about how he finds inspiration and hope during this current period of civil unrest.
In the context of what's going on in our country today, through the prism of art, almost by definition, a novelist or a playwright has a more arduous task in terms of responding immediately and turning inspiration based on something that's happening right now into art. A poet or a songwriter, a painter can get that out. In your context, how do you deal with the emotion that might surface after the murder of George Floyd or Rayshard Brooks, or the events subsequent to that? Do you immediately respond creatively? Do you take notes? Do you file it away? The second part would be, is the nature of your work such that it's sort of a cumulative process? You do file it away, and it's going to surface at some other point. Any of this make sense?
Perfect sense, and I think all artists land somewhere on that continuum. I'm not one to respond in the moment for the thing that's happening in the moment. I don't know that I file it away, but I particularly love history. I particularly love African American history. I think all of my plays are in some shape, form, or fashion dealing with a historical moment, just everyday people in an historical moment. And so, as we spoke about before, for me, this is a bit of it's a continuum. You know, it's a much larger conversation. And I don't know how other artists think about this, but certainly for myself, I would rather my play not just land right on top of the moment, or my poem just land right on top of the moment and kind of, you know, hit you in the head with this thing that's happening in the moment. I'd rather have something that has some intimacy and particularity about it, but is a larger conversation about, you know, especially the history of Black folks on the continuum. So whether it's Black folks returning from World War II or trying to navigate Reconstruction, or, you know, issues happening between fathers and sons in the Black community, you know, I personally would rather have a larger conversation. And so I feel the moment. The moment is important, but the moment operates as part of a continuum. I was saying to a friend of mine the other day, I'm actually lucky in this moment because I can act. I can do some concrete things because of my professional career and position. So, you know, I can march, but I can also make some concrete institutional changes where I am. And I think for me, it's acting upon a moment or taking advantage of a moment, hopefully in a positive way, to create some changes or move people because the moment has pressed them into some action, so that I kind of get it out of me. You know, I'm kind of in a better position in that way, where I know friends of mine who are just home, you know, and they don't have that availability to act upon the situation, and it's eating them. I can see it. I can hear it. So I consider myself lucky in that particular vein. So my art doesn't have to immediately address it either, you know, because I have another outlet.
You sort of, I think, indirectly referred to a couple of your works when you were answering just then. And I haven't read all of your works, but I have seen parts of Willie's Cut and Shine. And forgive me if I'm wrong, but that refers to an incident in the 1950s that would sort of, sadly enough, mirror a lot of what's happening 70 years later. Is that accurate to say? And in the cumulative way of expression that you're talking about, or assimilating material?
Yeah, most definitely. And you are quite accurate. It's, a few years after World War II, it is the murder of a prominent Black man in a community down south. It deals with the kind of social issue of the races, but it also, I hope also deals with, within the Black community, different ways of thinking about a moment. So my grandparents' generation, young men just returning from war generation, younger folks who have not, gone to war and are just looking at their elders for some guidance. So it's trying to have that much larger conversation and, what people will sacrifice, in that moment, in order to hang on to their dignity and their humanity. And so you're absolutely right. And I did refer to that. And I think I didn't think about it at the time. And to be honest with you, Rick, I didn't think about it till you just brought it up, how it kind of mirrors this particular moment. But you're right, it is on a continuum. And I think certainly for Black history, we find these kind of touch points across the historical spectrum from 1600 forward in this particular country, where, it's a moment. It's a moment where we're sitting on the fulcrum and we could go either way. And I'm so interested in kind of deconstructing, in the theater, those particular moments and what caused us to either fall on this side of the fulcrum or on this side of the fulcrum. But yeah, I'm absolutely fascinated by those moments. And so this will arise somewhere at some time. I'm in no hurry.
What you just said, and I have been asking everyone that we have spoken with about this. When Sandy Hook happened, my wife and I looked at each other and we said, of all the mass shootings that continue to go on in this country, the nature of that particular incident, this is going to be it. This is going to be the thing that changed it all. Sadly, it doesn't look as though we were correct. There is a lot of spirit and energy and cautious optimism right now with what's going on in the wake of these recent police killings. That makes me optimistic again. There really might be change. And I wonder if part of it is because we're going through a plague. We are shut down in our own homes. We are in a presidential administration that has made a lot of people frustrated, and we're in economic trouble. If we have to undergo those bad things to make it possible to give us the time and the energy and the rage and the opportunity to move this forward, do you see that as you got maybe a little more optimism than what the past has indicated might happen?
I have a lot more optimism. I mean, I guess we can never underestimate the ability of human beings to search for the bottom, because we
I don't know why I'm laughing at that, but yes, yeah.
We have done our best to get to the bottom and create a perfect storm. But on the other side of that, you can never underestimate the human capacity to rise above even the worst moment. And so here we are again. And what if those fulcrum moments and the fact that we are home, and this is happening and we're stewing, and COVID has placed us at home. And economically, there's just a lot of fear and anxiety about where we are. And, I think it is the human being's desire to act, right? That is part of that anxiety about being home. and being in interaction with people. And so this moment happens, and maybe we wanted to do something, you know, when Tamir, you know, or Michael Brown, we wanted to do something, but we also had a lot of things we had to act upon. We had to pay the light bill. We got to pay the rent and the mortgage. We got to go back to our own lives at some, you know, point. And not about being selfish, it's just about our realities. And so
it's life. Yeah.
It's life. I think you're absolutely right. We're just in that moment. Not to mention the presidency. And, you know, I don't mind saying, you know, how I feel about the current presidency, which is like I feel like it's a total disaster. And so I think that people have all these things playing upon them. And this is a moment when they can act. This is a moment when they can put their feet on the concrete, you know, and make some things happen. Even if it is just to go out protest and put their voice in the air. And so, as I said to my colleagues, I teach at a local university in Connecticut. And as I said to my colleagues, you know, does it look like I'm being opportunistic? Yes, I am. I'm being opportunistic. This opportunity didn't move us like Sandy Hook, Tamir, and Michael. They didn't move us in the way that we had hoped. But here's another moment, and it's a bigger moment. You know, and I'm optimistic because I look at that protest crowd and I see every color of the rainbow. I see every ethnicity, way more than I have ever seen before. And that's what makes a movement happen. We're thinking about doing in our theater a letter from the Birmingham jail. You know, so I've read it about 9 times. And that conversation that Martin Luther King is having with the white clergy at the time, you know, is a touch point for us to see how much we were still divided at that particular moment and how far we've come. And so I'm with you, Rick. I think this is the moment. And if we do not take advantage of this moment, you know, as I said to my colleagues, this is not a pop-up change kind of moment. This is not a moment when we should focus on Black playwrights for a year. This is a moment for institutional change. So when I'm dead and gone, we will still be operating in this way. It's a moment.
I'm interested in why artists pursue a particular artistic discipline. I have a very good friend who was drawn to acting when we were in what they then called junior high because he thought Neil Simon was hilarious. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, we were 10 years old or what. And he ended up doing Beth Henley plays on Broadway and reading Richard III with Al Pacino. And he also was in a Kenny Rogers movie. So it goes all over. But the point is, what initially seduced you about theater and playwriting as something you wanted to pursue? And how have you been able to distill the possibilities from maybe an earlier Neil Simon's funny moment to where you are in your artistic development? And I'm not trying to diss Neil Simon. I'm just saying.
I was having a conversation with a playwright I'm supporting yesterday, having conversations with about their work, and she loves Neil Simon. And I was saying, I don't know anybody who writes a more efficient play. It's a woman, you know, that's what did it for me, you know, dating a young lady. I had begun writing because I love to read. I love historical fiction. I love historical accounts. And so I thought at some point in time I'd write the great American novel. Couldn't get past page 7. But I fell in love with that Black female poets, actually, Sonia Sanchez and Gwendolyn Brooks and Alice Walker and a few others. And so I started writing a lot of poetry. Went into the Navy, continued writing, and Essence Magazine, which is a Black women's magazine, been around a while. They started, you know, publishing a few poems, got that $25 check. Rick, I thought I was on top of the world. Like, I'm a rock.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I was stationed out in Washington State and close to Seattle. I was dating a young lady. I'm a jazz fanatic. And so, you know, I'd come off the ferry at the public market and we'd go listen to some jazz. She had tickets to a theater. and one evening said, you know, I want to go see this show, got front row seats. And I was like, that is not for me. Theater is a place where really smart people go. I am not that smart. I'm not trying to be embarrassed. So, you know, there's a nice little trio plan at the University Cafe. What are we waiting on? And she said, well, you know, you have a ball, but it'll be a short night for you because I'm going to the theater. And she was fine, Rick. She was fine. So I was not looking for a short night. And it was Ma Rainey's Black Bottom by August Wilson, who I had never heard of. We sat in the front row. And when that was done, that was it. I said, I'm not doing anything else but writing plays. That's what I'm doing. That's the world that I
love that.
Yeah.
I love stuff like that.
That's what I want to be in. And you may know this or not, but every military base has a small community theater. Doesn't matter the branch, doesn't matter where it is. There's a community theater. So, you know, I went and found out about that, walked in the door. Nobody knows what they're doing. Right. And it's captains and enlisted and, you know, officers, but it's very egalitarian. And so you walk in the door and say, I want to act. Great. Here's a play. Act it. I want to direct. Great. So I walked in and said, I'm a playwright. Never written a word of a play. They said, great. Write a play. And the first play I acted in was Neil Simon's Barefoot in the Park. So.
Oh, you're kidding.
There you go. Wow. But that's where I began, you know, in the
Navy.
Yeah, that's how it started. And I haven't looked back.
I am fascinated in how the theater, maybe in ways we didn't anticipate even 20 years ago, and I'm thinking about in our community, Writers Block, Inc., that is providing young people with opportunities, again, that I don't think I would have thought of 20 years ago. Spoken word, everything behind it. It's kind of like what you just described with the military base. It's like, you want to come in and write? Do it. You want to come in and act? Do it. You want to work on the lights and sound? All of that stuff. Have you seen in your experiences, and I know you've done a lot of workshops as well as what you do at UConn, do you see this increased interest in the opportunities that young folks are having and how, in particular, it resonates and reflects the world around them?
I just have to say that for me, and it surprises me when we go out to recruit, that we get as many students as we do, because as a parent, I would probably be scared to death if my son or daughter said, I'm going to be an actor. I'm going to be a director. I would be scared to death, but they keep coming in the door. And I think they keep coming in the door because first of all, it's intoxicating to step out in front of people and step into another skin as a writer or an actor, to step into another skin and amplify that voice. And there's some part of you that's always a part of that process. So you don't disappear, right? You just become an element of that, and then you amplify that. And I think the reason why theater will never go away, live theater will never go away, is because we are always in a need, right? To express ourselves and to amplify that and still have a bit of safety. Right? We have a little bit of a safety net. It's not Michael Bradford stepping out there. You know, it's Chi-Town from Willie's Cut and Shine. He's me and he's not me, you know, at the same time. And it just gives them an opportunity to step out there and shine and see the world reflected, you know, through them, which is when you see it happen and they're really living in that space, it's absolutely beautiful. I can't think of a better job to have. And I think more so now than ever, more students of color are coming in the door. And I think it's because their voice is not landing out in the world and in the community in the ways that they would like for it to land or to be heard. And so we are continually trying to find ways to amplify that voice for them, you know, or to support them in the amplification of their voice when they come in the door. I hope I get to do this for a long time. because it's
I bet you do.
I get a lot out of it.
You know, as a 65-year-old white guy who spent far too much time in his life playing in progressive rock bands with 18-minute songs and stuff, I have always and more marvel over the magical element that has transformed hip-hop into sort of ushered spoken word, and it has become integrated into theater and things like that. And again, we're seeing young people express themselves in ways with an eloquence that I would never have thought of when I was 17 years old. So it just keeps evolving, and it is very encouraging, empowering.
I mean, that's what keeps the lifeblood flowing, I think, in performative, and exhibition forms, because it just keeps evolving. And every culture brings in a particular kind of flavor that is part and parcel of how they live, right? And so it took a minute, you know, in the theater department to say, okay, the Western canon and Shakespeare and the rest, okay, I understand we need to have that in the training. But for the Latinx, you know, young person who comes in the door, the African-American young person, the Asian person that comes in the door, you know, how do we say that your cultural experience is not only valid, but is part and parcel of how we think about the world? So we can't like center ourselves in Shakespeare because he is quote unquote the be all, the end all. You know, we have got to figure out Dumas and the rest of these individuals and Calderon, you know, who brought something to the table that are part of the cultural history and experience of folks. And they may not even know it, but they deserve to know it. And they deserve to bring that cultural flavor, you know, in the door. If we don't do that, then, you know, it will become a dead form. And so that spoken word, I love this play, American Huang Gap by Lloyd Suh. It has a particular rhythm on its own. This is how we continue to evolve, as you said. Right. It's that evolution. It's fresh water. It's fresh water coming in. You know, if we don't evolve, we become stagnant and nobody's drinking that water. You know what I mean? So it's got to be a continued evolution. And we have to remind ourselves sometimes, you know, and this is one of those moments that reminds ourselves. Right. That reminds us if they're at the door and they want to come in, open the door, let everybody in the door. Matter of fact, go welcome them. In the door, there's the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis has a philosophy called radical hospitality. I love that. And I instituted many of those policies at Connecticut Repertory Theater last year. And just the relationship with the patrons, you know, brings us to a whole, you know, brought us to a whole new place over the course of the year. So theater is, it's my vehicle, it's the vehicle I chose to get in, right? To present myself out to the world and help other people find their voice. There's so many, but this is the one that, you know, that I'm sitting in, that's all.
As always, you are eloquent and make me think, and I love that. And is there something you would like to add, Michael, that we didn't talk about? I mean, I know we could go all day probably, but.
I just want to say, I really appreciate you taking the time. You know, the piece that you wrote in the paper and the breakdown of that, giving artists the opportunity to really kind of think about themselves, you know, what this moment means. I think sometimes we operate the way we operate, we don't think deeply about it. And so we need you to ask that question so that we can deconstruct that a little bit. And then this format as well, because I think I think that whenever we have found ourselves in this country at a touch point moment where there's some difficulty going on, I have noticed how theater thrives in that moment. And I think we are a lot looking towards the artist to have a larger, more emotional, more global idea, you know, about that moment, right? I'm interested in that kind of art, right? That gives me the specific for me to access, but then presses me into a larger way of thinking about the world. And sometimes those conversations don't happen, or we're not clear about that until we get asked a really good question. So I just want to say I really appreciate you taking the time to step into this space.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to this podcast on Google Play, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. If you use Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us, as that helps us reach more people. Thanks for listening.